KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to the first edition of the winter quarter schedule of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Hope you've had a good new year. Hope you've had a good winter. I'm excited about this quarter schedule that I will be posting over the next couple of days, but we're starting off show number 201 in 2014 with Jonathan Band of his own operation, PolicyBandwidth.com, and Policy Bandwidth, the company. Jonathan is someone who has been around intellectual property law and technology for a few decades at this point, and he's been involved in a variety of areas ranging from the DMCA in the late 1990s through SOPA. He's also heavily involved in issues involving the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and now the upcoming TTIP. He is someone who has been, at its core, a technology policy, and particularly IP policy specialist for a few decades, and someone whose work I have followed both in my own work and generally following technology. So Jonathan is someone who I'm very excited to have on the show today and with whom we are going to have a pretty wide-ranging discussion, ranging from issues involving remedies and damages in copyright infringement through issues involving how technology and intellectual property policy is made these days in Washington, and also talking about international trade and transparency issues as well as the substance. So I'm very excited to have Jonathan on, who is joining us via Skype from his home in Washington, D.C. This is a great way, really, to start off this quarter, because, in particular, where 2014 looks to be a year where quite a bit of policy may very well continue to be made in the world of IP and, in fact, trade. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that I have been particularly interested in covering the international law issues around IP, because I don't think they get nearly enough coverage. And they're very interesting, but also, I think, critically important. Based upon the impact that those laws can have on domestic laws, not just in the United States, but elsewhere. But we've also spent a lot of time on Hearsay Culture talking about other challenging policy issues, one of which, and of course related to international IP issues, is this very difficult question of what, in fact, is the harm associated with copyright infringement. We all assume, I don't think it's an unfair assumption, that there is harm, but the question is how much and what should the law do or not do to deal with it? How much should we change the law? How much does the law work well? And really, what price are we willing to pay to have a system that very vigorously goes after infringers or pirates? Are we willing to forego or curtail rights like fair use and other expressive rights that exist in copyright law for purposes of allowing for growth and development? Or do we think that copyright infringement and piracy is such a serious issue that that price should be paid? That's an issue that has vexed policymakers certainly the entire time I've been in the practice of IP law, really since the late 1990s, and of course this problem goes back decades and even centuries before then. This is an issue which is now at front and center in TPP, but also was front and center a few years ago with SOPA and PIPA. We've had recent discussions on Hearsay Culture involving the very controversial issues around patent trolls or non-practicing entities or patent assertion entities. That's not a topic we're going to spend a lot of time on today, except that it is, again, part of this broad policy spectrum that we're dealing with. Now, of course, Congress has dealt with patent trolls very recently. Congress did patent reform about a year ago, so we've seen those changes. 2014 already looks like it's going to be a year where the Supreme Court will be speaking on a couple of issues, and I think this is a good time today, in the beginning of January, beginning of the new year, to kind of get a fix on what policymakers might be thinking and how really policy is made on these issues in Washington with someone who's been at the center of it for quite a long time. By way of very brief background, as I mentioned, Jonathan Band now runs his own practice, Policy Bandwidth. He is someone who represents clients in connection to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the WIPO Treaty for the Visually Impaired. He was involved in the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement issues, ACTA, a couple of years ago. He has a variety of both substantive and practice backgrounds in these areas. He's an adjunct professor at Georgetown. He's written, in fact, a book that I referred to, Interfaces on Trial and Interfaces on Trial 2.0. He's a prolific writer. He received his his bachelor's degree from Harvard College, his JD from Yale. He was a partner for 20 years at Morrison & Foerster in Washington, and he established his own law firm in May 2005. Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Hearsay Culture.
Dave, thank you very much for having me.
So let me start off, Jonathan, with a question I ask most people, and I'm going to ask this, particularly given that you're a practicing attorney and someone who's involved in these policy issues, I think it's a fun question to ask. Tell us how you got involved in the IP policy issues that I mentioned in your introduction.
Well, if you always have to start at the very beginning, and by way of background, you should know that my father is a professor of comparative literature. So I grew up in a house that was very, we always were talking about literature and so literature was very much, literature in particular, but the other arts in general were very much in the air. When I went to law school, I found myself much more interested in the cases in my intellectual property class, and in particular the copyright section of the intellectual property class, because remember, in those days most law schools just had one class on intellectual property. You didn't have the multiple classes that typically law schools have now. There was one class on intellectual property. That was it. And I took it, and within that class I found the copyright cases to be the most interesting. Relative to all the other cases, in all the other classes, and I think it was just the subject matter, it was a lot more interesting to be reading about cases involving, literature and film and paintings and so forth, as opposed to real property or torts or contracts or what have you. When I went to the law firm right after law school, I joined Morrison & Foerster, actually they did not have much of a IP practice then. Now, of course, they have a very extensive IP practice. But most of my work was in the antitrust area and in the energy regulatory area and other administrative law areas. But I let everyone know that whenever there was a copyright issue, I wanted it. And so in my first two or three years, from time to time, a little copyright issue would dribble into the office. This was into the D.C. office of Morrison & Foerster, which was much smaller than the San Francisco office. I'd glom onto whatever case came in or whatever, little project came in, writing a memo about this or answering a question about that. And then a big case came up. Fujitsu entered into this very complex arbitration with IBM, and I started working on that. The firm was representing Fujitsu, and that led to policy work in the on questions relating to software copyright. The scope of protection for computer programs in particular, are interface specifications protected by copyright? And then that the related issue is reverse engineering lawful? Those are the subjects of the two books you mentioned, Interfaces on Trial and Interfaces on Trial 2.0. So much of my early policy practice was very much focused on the software interoperability issues. And then, one thing led to another, then I just got very involved in the DMCA, originally much more specifically on the circumvention issues. And again, as you may recall, in Section 1201, there's an interoperability exception to the prohibition on circumvention. So I got involved with that. And then, it's again been one thing leading to another, but again, in many ways, like I said, it all starts with sitting around the dinner table talking about literature.
Give us a little bit of a sense, if you will, of your clients. I mentioned, very briefly, but just so we have a sense of the breadth of your practice, what kind of clients do you tend to represent in these matters?
So I have two baskets of clients. I represent library associations. And I represent technology companies and technology associations on the policy issue. So in many respects, they're both in the same business of making information accessible. It's just that some clients are for-profit and some clients are non-profit. But they really are in the same information access business.
Now, given that your practice is in Washington and we're focusing heavily on policy, for those that are curious, are you registered as a lobbyist on any of these issues?
Yes, and in fact, today I had to do my quarterly lobbying disclosure filing. You know, using a very clunky online system that Congress has. You know, in terms of its efficiency, it's, you know, comparable to the healthcare.gov site.
You know, and I tell you, I mean, formatting and searchability is one of those great vexing issues, which perhaps I'll come back to maybe later in an interview. And what I have to be careful of as a radio host is that I don't get polemical, because then I'd start giving a speech about my concerns about information access when it comes to basic stuff like formatting. So good. Well, let's start here, because I mentioned briefly your background on policy, and it runs the range. Let's jump right in on this policy making side, and I'll ask you this kind of broad question, and we can tailor it shortly. But you know, we're recording this show on January 8th, 2014. Now it's going to air next week. But what is your sense of technology policy implementation right now? And I'll start the question in this broad way, and answer it as you choose. Do legislators, and I will limit you to Congress, which is plenty, get it? Do they understand what's going on when it comes to technology? What's your take on that?
No. I think they don't understand, but that really is not all that surprising. I mean, when you consider how much, you know, how the technology is constantly changing, it's very hard, for me to keep up with it. And frankly, I don't. I'm probably sort of 10 years behind the technology curve. And so you have this industry where, you know, the actual technology is evolving constantly. The business models are evolving constantly. You have, you know, companies that are very important now that didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago. And that's very hard. I mean, it's very hard for anyone to keep up with, and it's particularly hard for people who don't really specialize in the area to keep up with. So the net result is that the vast majority of members of Congress just don't understand the issues and the complexities to the extent they might with other areas. Now, of course, you do have certain members of Congress who do understand, and it sort of makes sense. If you have, I'd say, you know, someone like Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, you know, she's in the Bay Area, she represents you know, Silicon Valley, and so she understands. She's very aware of what goes on, and the complexities and the subtleties and so forth. But if you have a member of Congress from Nebraska, you know, why would they know? Now, they know farm policy, but they're not going to know anything about tech. So, you know, I think part of it is a natural reflection of the way Congress works, but also the fact that this is just such a new and evolving industry.
Now, what would you say about the role, and we're getting into the weeds of policymaking, but I mean, given that IP and technology are those areas where, you know, Congress is regularly active, I think it's worth spending a little time on. So what would you say about the staffers, right? I mean, the staff members that are assigned and work for members of Congress, on these issues, what would you say about their relative knowledge and understanding of these issues?
Well, I'd say it's very uneven. Part of that is the fact that you have a tremendous amount of turnover. And so even though like a member of Congress will typically, you know, can keep his or her seat for a long time, there isn't that much turnover there or in the Senate. There is a lot of turnover with staff in a variety of reasons of pay, the low pay, you know, being a significant reason. So a lot of staffers will not stay in any given office for more than two or three, you know, 2 years, 3 years, or some do stay much longer, but a lot of them, there's a lot of turnover, or they go from one office to the other office, you know, they get promoted, or they, you know, go from the House to the Senate, and, you know, but the bottom line is that you do have a lot of turnover, certainly on the personal staff, but on, you know, less so on the committee staff, but there's turnover there too. And so, you know, the level of understanding varies. The second factor is that at the end of the day, you know, even with committee staff, a lot of them are lawyers, right? They're not technology people. I mean, the business of Congress is laws. And so, in the end, a lot of the staffers you're going to be dealing with are lawyers, not, you know, not people with a technology background. And so they're, you know, operating at the same disadvantage that, you know, lawyers more generally are operating at, that, you know, we have to get involved in translating issues from, you know, business and technology issues into legal terminology. But, you know, if, you know, at the end of the day, most of us are lawyers and we have legal training and, you know, we don't really, you know, we don't code, most of us. And so you know, we don't really understand, we understand the technology, but only to a point. So the fact that they don't, you know, that the level of understanding only goes so far. And then on top of it is even to the extent that they're lawyers, they're not by and large IP lawyers. You know, to the extent that we're focusing on, let's say, IP policy. So let's say on the Judiciary Committee, whether it's again, committee staff, or more likely personal staff, I mean, maybe they have some IP background, but, you know, the Judiciary Committee covers many areas, not just IP. You know, they get involved in immigration and gun control and all kinds of other issues. Now again, if you're just talking about the IP subcommittee, you know, again, they're the staff people in the IP subcommittee do have a lot of expertise on IP law. Some have more or less background with technology, but the personal staff, for many members of, if you have a member of the Judiciary Committee, he has a staffer or she has a staffer who is responsible for Judiciary Committee issues, but not just IP issues. Even if they're on the IP subcommittee, they will still be involved in, they will cover the spectrum of Judiciary Committee issues, and so they're likely not to have much of an IP background. Over time, they might get some expertise, but again, because of the turnover issue that I mentioned. Yeah. So the net effect is that there isn't a great depth of understanding of or great depth of background that's being brought to the table in terms of either technology or IP.
We're chatting with Jonathan Band of Policy Bandwidth on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Jonathan, what's the effect of all of that? I mean, you know, if most members of Congress don't understand, if there's high turnover among the staff and the staff themselves are uneven, I mean, superficially it sounds like things are pretty bad. Are there countervailing forces, if you will, that allow for policy implementation to occur in ways that don't sound at least as superficially stark as it would seem the net effect of these would be, or is it really as bad as it sounds?
Well, I guess I guess at a certain level it is as bad as it sounds. You do have, I would say there are a couple of countervailing forces. One is you have, you know, the army of lobbyists, and you have lobbyists representing every potential interest, and then you, and so a lot of work ultimately is delegated to the lobbyists. A lot of it is by way of negotiation. So, you know, most, it's always very funny when you hear about when a member of Congress whether a senator or a representative has said, oh, so-and-so drafted this piece of legislation. And, you know, you kind of have to, you know, chuckle because you sort of say, well, not only did they not draft it, you know, there's a good chance they never read it. A lot of the drafting is the product of negotiations between stakeholders. And often staff act as referees. And so I've, in many cases, I've been in I've been in these negotiations moderated by staff. And depending, you know, there's all sorts of different formats, but the vast majority of, you know, in many areas that I've worked on, the legislation, you sort of say who actually wrote this word or who wrote that word, you know, this phrase, this section. And a lot of it is done by lobbyists under the supervision of staff. And so in that sense, you know, as long as you have, as long as the lobbyists have technical expertise, which they typically do, and as long as, especially once you get to the negotiating stage, and as long as, you know, the right people are in the room, which, amazingly enough, typically is the case, that's why the product ends up being, even though it could be messy and more complicated than it needs to be and so forth, in its own peculiar way, the process ultimately works. But it does work because you do have, you know, the people who ultimately do the drafting are the stakeholders. Under the supervision of staff. And then there's, just because of the way the process works, there's many opportunities for, you know, other stakeholders that were not, you know, to get their input, to make their input and to get heard. So there's varying degrees of clarity and transparency and opaqueness, but ultimately the process ends up being pretty transparent in the long run. I mean, because you're talking about, you know, it has to go through the whole committee process in the House, and it has to go to the Senate, and then back to the House. So there's many, many opportunities for influence and things to be worked out. Of course, there's also lots of opportunities for things to be slowed down and obstructed. It's obviously much easier to prevent legislation from going forward than to advancing it. And I'm sure we'll get to this more, but that stands sort of in stark contrast to the process with these international agreements where there's much, much less transparency. That ends up being a much more frightening process for stakeholders because, you know, the worst thing is when you actually do have the members of Congress or whatever, that's always the threat actually that staff use when they want to, if they really want to get stakeholders to reach agreement, they always threaten to say, okay, well, if you guys can't reach an agreement, then, you know, the members are going to talk among themselves and they'll reach an agreement. And you know, you don't want that result. And that's absolutely true because again, as we said before, they don't, you know, the members don't understand the nuances and the details, and you actually do want the stakeholders to reach the agreement, again, under the staff supervision.
So, Java, you did render me almost superfluous, because that's exactly the contrast I think is worth drawing. So, you know, again, you know, you have been heavily involved both on the domestic side but also on the international side. This has been a topic we talked about a few times on Hearsay Culture, but for the uninitiated, I'll give you the opportunity, as compared to the process of lawmaking in Congress, describe, if you will, from a transparency and input standpoint, your take on the Transcontinental Partnership Agreement, which is at the moment the leading IP-related international agreement currently being negotiated.
Right. So as you indicated, you have this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement under negotiation. The United States is participating, as well as other Pacific Rim countries. The number, you know, the number of parties participating keeps on increasing. It was originally, you know, countries like Singapore and Malaysia and Brunei and Chile and Peru, Australia, Vietnam, but now they've added on Canada, Mexico, Japan. So there's a lot of countries involved, but there is very little transparency. You'll have a round of negotiations. There'll be a press conference where they'll talk about what they did, but at no point is text actually released. There have been a couple of leaks of text, and so that has been most of the commentary about the IP chapter has mainly been based on these leaked texts. There was a leak a couple of years ago, or actually about 2.5 years ago, about the U.S. proposal. And then there was another big leak a couple of months ago. But even that leak that came out, I guess, at the end of November, beginning of December, was of a draft from August, so it was already out of date. And so you're able to comment on that. But other than that, you're always talking in the abstracts, even if you are able to meet with the negotiators from the United States or from the other countries. Your comments are always sort of high level and vague, because you don't have the current text in front of you, and you're not able to talk about the current text. And, you know, that again stands in stark contrast to what happens in Congress, where, when the bill is introduced, it's introduced publicly. Even before it's introduced, there are often discussion drafts that get circulated. At some point there might be closed door, you know, negotiations behind closed doors, but the ability, you know, before that, during that, after that, and also there's repeated steps along the way where you are able to see text and either participate directly in the negotiations about the text, or at least comment directly about the text. And of course, this is an area, as frankly all areas of law, where the details matter and the words matter. And so the ability to actually look at text and comment on text, as opposed to just talking concepts, which ends up being the case with the TPP, except for, again, of course, the leaks, is a dramatic contrast.
We're chatting with Jonathan Band of Policy Bandwidth on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU, which is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station. At Stanford University, it requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to do it. So Jonathan, let me ask you this, and by way of, you know, the pushback position. I mean, transparency, and it's an, you know, ill-defined term, but, you know, let's just say transparency for our purposes means having access to the texts themselves. At least from what I've seen, the primary argument against transparency as so defined that comes from the U.S. Trade Representative and others is that international agreements cannot be negotiated with that level of transparency, that you can't have the give and take and the horse trading and the push me pull you that goes on in lawmaking at the international level if you're going to have that kind of publicity. What's your response to that argument?
Well, I just think especially when I think it depends on the kind of agreement you're talking about. It could very well be that when you are talking about tariffs, where you're, you know, at some level, you know, really sort of screwing a certain industry and literally, you know, coming up with a rule that might decimate an industry, maybe that's the case. And you start to say, okay, well, we're going to set this tariff for this and that tariff for that, or you know, when you get into those kinds of numbers. But when you're talking about IP, it's quite different, and especially if you compare the level of transparency at the World Intellectual Property Organization with TPP, I mean, you're talking about dramatically different levels of transparency, and I just, you know, I've been involved, as you mentioned, with the over the past 2-3 years, very heavily with the treaty on for the visually impaired that was just adopted by WIPO, and you know, there at the end of there are certain you do have certain sessions which are closed, but certainly early on all the sessions are open. All the drafts, you see the language as it's emerging. For every meeting of the SCCR, that's the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights. I mean, for the initial several years of the process, I think the whole process of this, the whole negotiation on this treaty took about 10 years. I mean, WIPO moves pretty slowly, but every draft was public. Now it could be that certain, and so every 3 or 4 months you'd have another draft that would be publicly available, and you could comment on it. You could meet with people and offer specific comments. So, you know, in that level of transparency, again, it's not quite as transparent on the whole as what goes on in Congress. But it was pretty transparent, and again, like I said, there were certain sessions, especially towards the end, what they called informal sessions or informal sessions, where you weren't in the room, you weren't able to hear what was being said, but even there, you had the regular sessions where you were in the room and you could hear what's being said. You had informals where you just got an audio, you weren't in the room, but you got an audio feed, and then you had the informals where you really didn't get anything. But it's still, even then, you would still see within, after a negotiating session, they might the next morning, release text about what was discussed the previous day or the previous evening. And so you really have the ability to comment on it. And the point is that they did reach a treaty. They did arrive at a treaty through that process, and they've, you know, WIPO has reached many treaties over the years. And so the notion that you cannot, and there are a lot more members participating in WIPO than in TPP. So the notion that you can't have a negotiation with a degree of transparency, I think simply is disproved by the WIPO experience.
So you know, I suppose I'm asking you to speculate here a little bit, but given your experience, it's worth asking. So what explains TPP's relative secrecy? Is it the fact that it's being run through the U.S. Trade Representative? Is it the nature of lawmaking today? I mean, what's your sense as to the why? I mean, why is this happening with this agreement now?
Yeah, I think it's true that trade agreements historically don't have a lot of transparency. And again, part of it is, as I said, it had to do with the nature of, you know, historically the nature of trade agreements, where you're, you know, opening up, you know, taking down barriers, getting access to markets in ways that would be very harmful to certain industries. And so you really do need to have that kind of horse trading. And maybe that does need to happen behind closed doors. Whereas historically IP treaties have been negotiated in, you know, bodies like WIPO, and you have different parts of the U.S. government involved in those discussions. So I think part of it is, you know, but with these free trade agreements, you have IP injected into the trade context, and so once it gets injected, moved from the IP fora like WIPO to the trade fora, then the rules change, because, you know, you have different, you know, the different history in different parts of the government. But, you know, and it's not just the U.S. I think it's the other countries too. I mean, I think they all, this is how they do trade agreements, but it's the problem. The problem here is having an IP discussion in the trade context, then you end up with the trade rules as opposed to the IP rules of negotiation.
So, Jonathan Band, Policy Bandwidth, let me turn to, I mean, the procedure, frankly, at least, and this is speaking personally, has become at least as important as the substance, because it's dictating what the substance will look like. But I don't want to spend the entire time on procedure, and I do want to turn to the substance of IP law. And I'll ask you a broad question. I do want to get into the issue of copyright damages and some recent analysis you've done. But before I get to that, I mean, you know, in terms of what you see as the most contentious IP issues on the international stage right now, what are they? And I know that there are several, but if you could identify or perhaps highlight one or two that you think are ultimately major sticking points in terms of what IP law would look like, what would they be?
Well, you know, there's a lot of issues in the patent sphere, mainly dealing with, you know, with pharmaceuticals, but that's outside of my area of expertise. So, you know, in many ways, those are the most contentious. And, you know, there's the most at stake, because the availability of generic drugs and so forth, you know, you're really talking about people's lives.
Right.
But in the copyright space, You know, what is the top priority keeps on changing, and it depends on who you're talking to and again the exact forum. You know, certainly one of the issues that has been very important for the tech industry in the TPP context has been exceptions and limitations generally, and in particular coming up with a way of exporting fair use. I mean, we think that fair use has been incredibly helpful to the development of the tech industry and frankly the creative industries in this country. And we think that having exporting fair use and the flexibility of fair use to other countries would not only allow tech companies to operate in those countries, but would be good for those countries as well, and good for culture in those countries. And so that's been a major issue, a focus of our attention. But you still have the same sort of countervailing issues of people very worried about infringement and enforcement. So there is a lot of tension surrounding that issue. I mean, another issue that has gotten a lot of attention has to do with exhaustion, and that was, you know, the issue in the first sale doctrine and Kurtzsang, the Supreme Court case this past year, And then, you know, that plays out in TPP, and would the language in TPP, undermine Kurtzsang? Would it reinforce Kurtzsang, export Kurtzsang? So those are some of the issues that have been very contentious.
Exhaustion is a topic that obviously we could spend an entire show on, but for those that aren't familiar, because I don't want exhaustion to be I'm exhausted listening to this interview, but rather exhaustion as in what it means from a copyright standpoint. So for those that are not familiar, if you could give, recognizing this is a short amount of time, but maybe the 90-second version of what exhaustion is and what the issue is.
Right, so exhaustion is the notion. So to back up, in copyright is a bundle of rights. You have a reproduction right. You also have a distribution right. So that gives the rights holder the exclusive right to distribute a copy. There is a very fundamental exception to the distribution right, and that's the principle of first sale or exhaustion. It's sort of the same thing, which is that the distribution right is exhausted after the first sale of a copy. So I can control the first sale of the copy, but once I sell it to someone, that person is allowed to resell that copy without infringing my distribution right in that copy. So that's a basic concept that allows, you know, bookstores to operate and allows libraries to lend books, and it allows people to sell used works and so forth, used copies. It allows distribution chains, secondary markets, and all that. The big issue has to do with how does that intersect with the international context. So, I think in almost every country in the world there is the exhaustion principle, so that once I sell a copy to someone, that person is allowed to resell that copy. But what happens if I sell the copy in another country? Can that copy be sold into this country without my permission? And a lot of rights holders don't want international exhaustion, because they like to segment markets. They like to be able to sell works, sell products at different price points in different markets. And they like to have the copyright law allow them to do that. On the other hand, you do have the you have this countervailing force of people who like to arbitrage and buy something in one price and then export it or import it, you know, export it to another country and make money on the price differential. And so the Supreme Court in last year ruled that, you know, because there was an ambiguity in our statute whether we did have an international exhaustion or not, they ruled that our law was international exhaustion. So as long as it's a lawfully made copy and it's a lawfully acquired copy, you can import it to the U.S. and sell it in the U.S. So I can buy a product overseas and import it to the U.S. without infringing the distribution right or the importation right.
So, Jonathan, we are at what I call the unfair portion of the show, and that's where we have about 10 minutes left, and I start asking questions that you may not feel like you have adequate time to answer the way you would like, but then because it's my show, I do it anyway. And so I'm going to do that now because it's a nice lead-in to it. Just recently, you published some analysis you did of this critical question, right, which is ultimately, what are we arguing about, right? I mean, in other words, what is the real harm associated with these kinds of, you know, potential infringements? And you did an interesting analysis of regulatory filing. So talk to us a little bit about that analysis and what it indicated in terms of this fundamental question of what is the harm, what is the damage from all this activity?
Right. So as you indicated, you know, there is this, we have had this ongoing debate in Congress, you know, off and on for the past 15, 20 years about the infringement on the Internet and the harm that infringement on the Internet causes, and then what needs to be done. And so in response to that, and so you had, most recently, you mentioned the SOPA and PIPA, Before that, you had the Pro-IP Act. Before that, you had the Net Act. Before that, you had the DMCA. I mean, so you have this ongoing series of bills and legislation and controversy about dealing with the infringement problem, and especially the online piracy problem. The problem with that is it's hard to quantify how much harm is being caused. So there's been a lot of people running around Congress saying, okay, we need to change the law, we need to improve enforcement. But in terms of being to say, documenting how bad is the problem? Because as you indicated before, I mean, if the problem is very serious, then it requires, a very serious solution and it requires certain trade-offs. On the other hand, if it is not that big a problem, maybe it doesn't require a big solution. Maybe it doesn't require any solution at all. Maybe it doesn't require legislative changes. And so much of what we're trying to do, so much of this discussion has been, there's a lot of what's been going on in Congress has been sort of just an assumption. There's been an assumption that there is extensive harm. And a lot of what we've been trying to do is say, well, wait a minute, let's figure out, let's try to document the extent of the harm. Now, the content industries have, over the years, produced lots of studies that they say supports the notion that there has been extensive harm shown. In fact, a lot of what those studies show is that, that these industries employ a lot of people, but it doesn't really show that copyright, the importance of copyright to that, or relatedly, the harm that infringement has caused. On the other hand, various, the people in the tech industry have produced studies, either showing that there isn't much harm relating to infringement, or showing the importance of exceptions, or showing that sometimes exposure increases sales. I mean, there've been all kinds of studies on both sides, and you also have academics who have produced studies. But even with the academic studies, a lot of people say, well, they're biased. These academics really aren't neutral. They all come with their preconceived notions. So it's been very difficult to come up with, sort of neutral assessments of how bad is the problem, or, to the extent there is a problem. And then, sort of when I was working with my research assistant, we came across, I realized that you do have these, investment advisors like, Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan Chase and all these, Wells Fargo advisors. You have all these, investment firms, and they produce reports on a regular basis that they then make available to investors, to their clients, discussing what are the risks relating to certain publicly traded companies. And they're neutral. I mean, they are not, they have no bias, or in theory they're neutral. They're simply saying, they're trying to give impartial advice. Is this a good company to invest in? Or is this company facing problems? And so we looked at the studies that these these people, in theory, impartial experts in the field, have produced with respect to 8 different content industry companies, in the software industry, publishing, motion pictures, and record labels. And it turns out that in about 80% of the reports, copyright infringement wasn't even mentioned. And in certain industries, like in the publishing industry, it wasn't mentioned at all for any of the companies that we looked at. No investment advisor mentioned infringement. So that suggests that the harm or that infringement is causing these industries may well be overstated if 80% of the reports about these companies, again, neutral reports, don't even mention it as a problem at all, let alone a serious problem.
Now, is that, and again, we only have a few minutes, so just, you know, is that a function at all of the nature of these reports? In other words, and by that I should ask the question more directly, I mean, is there a logical explanation for why that information might not be reflected in these reports?
Well, actually, since we, you know, came out with the report, some people have said, well, maybe because the risk caused by infringement is so obvious and so widespread, no one mentions it. Well, it seems to me that even if it were a well-known and widespread risk, if it was a serious risk that really threatened the company, the report should say that, and it should say, you know, stay the hell away from this company. Mm-hmm. But of course they don't say that, and it also turns out, you know, these companies are all extremely profitable, and another study we came out with a few months ago showed that indeed copyright, you know, companies in the copyright space are more profitable than companies in many other segments of the industry, in many other industry sectors. All that suggests that this the sky is falling rhetoric that you hear inside the Beltway by rights holders is grossly overstated. Now that's not to say that there isn't some harm, that there aren't some sales being lost, but certainly not to the extent that the rights holders are suggesting.
We're chatting with Jonathan Band of Policy Bandwidth on KZSFM Stanford. So, Jonathan, we have about 3 minutes left, and I'm going to ask you this question. It's a quasi crystal ball question, which I don't often like to ask, but I will. Well, in terms of what IP issues you see being front and center, will they remain these issues of exhaustion, or are there any that are kind of flying under the radar screen from a policy perspective that you think are going to be more publicly debated in the coming year?
Well, I think one of the issues that will start receiving a lot more attention, you know, it does come out of first sale, but in a slightly different way. A lot of it has to do with the intersection between copyright and contract, and it's the fact that a lot of us are buying all of this digital content, or we think we're buying this digital content, but then there are license restrictions on it, or the rights holders are saying, well, you're really not buying the copy, you're just licensing the copy, and therefore you can't resell it. Now that we're more and more people are spending money on ebooks and iTunes music, and you know the issue of to what extent is that material transferable is going to become more and more important. Not only with purely digital media like again my ebook or my iTunes, but you also have the related issue of embedded software. More and more of our devices come with software, and in there too, the rights holders sometimes say, well, you're buying the device, but the software in the device is only licensed, and so you can't transfer the device, or you can transfer the device, but the purchaser has to buy the software again or pay an additional license fee for the software. And so that whole notion of what does it mean, you know, what is ownership mean in the 21st century, and do you really own your copies, and do you own the devices in which your copies are embedded? I think that whole nexus, that whole complex of issues, again, and there's a lot of overlap of it's, you know, part of its copyright, part of its contract, part of its, you know, the issues of preemption, very complicated issues of law. But I think that's going to become more important. People are going to be focusing more and more attention, particularly as more consumers spend more money on all of this digital stuff and then start discovering, well, that there's all these restrictions on transfer that they in the past didn't have that problem. And, you know, you could, you know, once you were done with a book, you could give it away. You could donate it to your library. You could, you know, give it to a friend. But the notion that you're not going to be able to do that, I think that that whole, that's going to be something that is going to be more of an issue going forward.
And that's an issue that came up in that Redigi case last year that I think, you know, is one that actually I'll table for now, but invite you back on the show to discuss, Jonathan.
Okay.
Jonathan Ban of Policy Bandwidth, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. It's been a great discussion. I sincerely mean it. I invite you back on the show to continue these discussions, and I thank you for taking the time to educate my listeners.
Okay, my pleasure.
So this quarter there's going to be a great roundup of guests. As I'm recording this show on January 8th, I am still in the process of finalizing that list. However, the next two guests are set, and I can mention those. Coming up next week will be Professor Ivan Krastev of Sofia, who's going to be on discussing issues of transparency policy and technology as well on the show. And then at the end of the month, Ethan Zuckerman, from MIT will be on the show. I am additionally finalizing the schedule, and by the time the show airs on January 15th, that schedule should be posted on hearsayculture.com, where you can find all previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule of the show. Additionally, you can listen to previous shows by going to the Stanford CIS iTunes page, where you can find not only all of Hearsay Culture's shows, but also other events going on at CIS. You can get the show by going to Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or you can also get the show by going to hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by going to dave@hearsayculture.com, and email me any comments that you have, both as far as substance but also as far as recording. I should mention that a number of listeners had emailed me over the last few months suggesting that I should not embed more than one show in a blog post because of the limitations of RSS, that RSS was basically grabbing only one of, if there were three or four shows posted, only one of those. And so in the interest of making sure that RSS listeners are able to access the show easily, I'm going to be on a going forward basis until something changes on that front, posting one show at a time. So as always, I will continue to post the shows on hearsayculture.com, but I will do that one at a time in separate posts. So thank you for joining me today. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.